Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to 10% Happier early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Next Monday, April 12th, we are launching a two-week series about hope. As we head deeper into spring and vaccines go into our arms, we here on the show are going to argue that hope is actually a skill, one you can get better at. And not only will we be exploring hope on the podcast, we'll also have bespoke meditations from our podcast guests dropping in the 10% Happier app so that you can actually practice hope as a skill. If you don't already have the app, you can get it now. Just download it for free wherever you get your apps and get started. From ABC, this is the 10% Happier podcast. I'm Dan Harris. To inject a little sunshine and perspective and some wisdom, we thought it might make sense to repost one of our favorite conversations of the last year. This is straight up meat and potatoes meditation talk from the one and only Joseph Goldstein. In this chat, we explore three profoundly useful meditation strategies, including mindfulness of thinking, awareness of rushing, a deeply ingrained habit for many of us, including your host, and the genuine insight that can emerge from everyday activities. For the uninitiated, Joseph is one of the founding teachers on the 10% Happier app. He's a co-founder of the Insight Meditation Society, and he is the author of several books, including the recently reissued The Experience of Insight, A Simple and Direct Guide to Buddhist Meditation. Speaking personally, as a friend and student of Joseph's, any time I have spent with Joseph is time well spent. And this conversation is no exception. So here we go with Joseph Goldstein. Hello, Joseph.
Hi, Dan.
Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, good to be with you.
Likewise. So in chatting before we started officially rolling here, we identified some areas of potential discussion. And one of the things you said that's been on your mind of late in your own practice is noticing the quickly passing little thoughts that zip through the sort of consciousness, our mind, and that we often don't notice. Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah. So this really came about for me when I was on a self-retreat, and I was just going for a walk. You know, so I wasn't doing, at that point, the slow meditative walk, but I was taking a walk reasonably mindfully. I noticed something quite vividly that I must have noticed beforehand, but it never stood out in quite the way it did, you know, at this particular time. And that was, as I was going for the walk, I noticed that there were many, many quickly passing thoughts that went through the mind, you know, maybe lasting 15 seconds or 30 seconds. So not long, and no big dramas. They weren't particularly problematic. And because of that, what I noticed was that I wasn't really being mindful of the fact that I was thinking during that time. It's like they were just coming, passing through, and leaving. But what I noticed was in those times, for the duration of the thought, as short as it was, I was not aware that I was thinking. I was dropped into the content of it, dropped into the story. You know, and then 15 seconds or 30 seconds later, it's like I come out from being lost in that quick little thought and back, you know, mindful of my body, mindfulness of walking. And it highlighted to me how often during the day we do drop in unknowingly, you know, to the stories we make up, you know, in our minds about our experience. So for me, for example, it might have been just some planning or maybe remembering something or maybe a quick little comment about what I was seeing. So it could be just the ordinary activity of the mind, you know, in our daily lives, and how frequently these quickly passing thoughts happen, and how for the most part, I hadn't been mindful in those short durations. And I realized a few things from this. One is that these unnoticed thoughts would, in a very subtle way, be conditioning different emotions. you know, and maybe a thought would make me a little more interested or sad or excited or whatever. And all on a very mild level, which is why we generally don't notice it. But what I saw was that every time we're in these thoughts unmindfully, you know, it's like we're lost in the dream for that short period of time. It is creating an inner mental environment. It's conditioning our inner environment. And even though it's for short durations, it's many, many times a day. So it was very interesting for me to see how our minds get conditioned very often unknowingly, you know, in these seemingly innocuous stream of thoughts. And there was one other little piece that stood out for me, that a lot of our ordinary thoughts in one way or another are self-referential. You know, it's a memory I had or a plan that I have or, you know, a reaction or a comment. And so every time we're lost in the dream of those thoughts, it's as if we're dreaming ourselves into existence, you know, over and over again. So that's why it just was very, as I said, it was very vivid for me at this particular time. And since then, I've just made it a practice, as I'm going through the day as best I can, just to keep an eye out, you know, going for a walk or doing some activity and just noticing, you know, when thinking happens and whether I'm actually aware of it or not. And it's become a very vibrant practice for me.
I'm putting myself in the shoes of novice meditators. Not hard for me to do because those are pretty much my shoes. And I'm thinking partially for myself and partially on behalf of the audience. You know, look, when I sit to meditate, I'm mostly lost in thought. So that's when I'm meditating, never mind when I'm just walking around during the rest of the day when I'm pretty sure thoroughly lost in thought. So is what you're describing after, you know, many years of meditation personally and being on retreat, is that scalable to the daily lives of civilians like us?
It's definitely scalable, but as with all practice, I think it's important not to have expectations about doing it perfectly or even near perfectly at first. I'll just give you an example. So this morning, you know, I got up and took a shower. And I was noticing just in the taking of a shower, you know, because it's kind of pleasant. You're there in the hot water and, you know, it's refreshing. And for some moments, you know, I was really quite mindful of the whole experience of the shower. And then my mind started thinking about something. And I couldn't remember whether I had actually shampooed my hair yet or not yet, which I had just done like 30 seconds before. But while I was doing it, I was lost in a thought. And then after, did I just wash my hair, didn't I? So it's just these little things. And it's really important to have a sense of humor about one's mind, about everything it's doing. Because if we have that attitude, then it's more conducive for interest. So it's not about judging or having some big expectation. It's just taking an interest in these very ordinary daily activities. And it will be easier when we're doing something where we're not engaged with other people, because then it will be harder. You know, we'll probably more likely be lost in the content of whatever we're discussing. But when we're doing things like taking a shower or going for a walk or even just walking from one room to another in one's apartment, you know, and just all those simple moments, that could be a place to watch for this. And I think if people do it and even kind of notice it a few times of how these thoughts are coming, and we're either aware of them as they come or we realize, oh, I was just lost for that 15 seconds. If we can do that even a few times, I think that will spark the interest to actually begin to make it a practice throughout the day. You know, so we just start wherever we are and we get a few hits of it. And if we do, I think it really will become interesting, because in a way, it's highlighting very explicitly the difference between delusion and wisdom. Right there. We can just see it when we're lost in the story, unmindful, we don't know it, we're lost, that's delusion. In the moment of becoming aware, oh, thinking. So that's wisdom. And so it's really pointing to a profound difference, even though the objects may seem very ordinary.
This practice sounds like counter-programming against the habitual.
Exactly. Good phrase there, Dan. I may use that.
I don't know how to meditate, but I'm pretty good at marketing, so as it turns out. So just to put a fine point on it, we're walking around, living our lives. Ideally, this is best practice, not in, you know, when we're in the throes of human interaction. We're walking from one room to the next. We're washing dishes. We're taking a shower with interest, not with gritted teeth. Notice the little thoughts that bubble up and notice how we get lost in them. And that act, that simple, friendly act, is the counter programming.
Yes, yes. And it's very revealing. And just to reiterate, just a point that I had made is to begin to notice over time, if people do find this of interest, to see how these short moments in subtle ways are conditioning how we feel about things. You know, because this is another kind of big area of meditative inquiry, that is the relationship of thought and emotion. These two are very interconnected. And the more we understand how thoughts condition different emotions and the reverse, that's also kind of a doorway into greater freedom.
So if we can catch the really, if we make a habit of sometimes catching these subtle and not dramatic little thoughts, we can see that those are often the beginning of a chain that can lead to more dramatic thoughts and then big overpowering emotions.
Yeah, not necessarily. They don't even necessarily have to escalate into bigger, more dramatic thoughts before it triggers emotions. So I'll give you an example. It came to mind actually just recently of a situation describing this very thing I'm talking about. So this is somewhat by way of confession to you and everybody listening.
Well, I'll assign you some Hail Marys afterwards, so go for it.
Okay. So one of the things that I do to relax, you know, at times is just to watch a good murder mystery on TV. You know, so that's,
oh, me too.
That's a favorite genre. And at a certain point, I realized that what was most conditioning my emotion as I was watching it was the background music. And mostly, until I had really explicitly noticed that, I was unaware of that. You know, I was just watching the story and thinking that what I was seeing was creating the emotion. But it really wasn't that at all. It was the music, you know, in the background. And I'm sure it's used very effectively to manipulate our emotions, you know, when they want to create some suspense or some anxiety or whatever it is, you know, or lightness. The music changes. And as soon as I started focusing on the music as well as what I was seeing, it really freed the mind from that unknowing mental reaction. And so our background thoughts are functioning in almost exactly the same way as the background music to our lives. They're pretty continual. Or continuous, one of the two. and they are influencing how we feel, just like the music in watching something, but we're unaware of it, you know? And so that, it really just opens up a whole place of greater freedom.
Because when we are caught in these emotions, which again, can be conditioned by these often subtle, slippery little thoughts that are just in the background, then, well, at least for myself, that's where I, you know, if I'm owned by some emotion that has, the whole chain has happened outside of my visibility from subtle thoughts building to an emotion, then I do a lot of stupid stuff.
Absolutely.
You're confirming that I do stupid stuff.
Just I've noticed. No, just teasing. But it does do that. But even short of that, it's the cause of a lot of suffering. You know, because it's like our emotions are being manipulated by things we're unaware of. You know, and as soon as we become aware, so then there's just a much greater spaciousness in the mind, you know, and there's much more place for discernment and choice. And we're not at the mercy of the background music.
This whole notion of responding instead of reacting, of not being owned by your emotion, this is what got me interested in the practice in the first place. So it's very powerful. And any way into that is intriguing to me.
Yeah. That's why, for me, this whole thing we've been discussing has been so interesting, because often, you know, in meditative circles, even though we say, you know, the practice is really our whole life, and it's the practice being mindful throughout the day, you know, the emphasis is usually on more formal meditation practice and what we learn from it. What was interesting to me in this particular exercise was that there was a depth of insight and understanding. It was not superficial, from very ordinary activities. You know, so it really started infusing, you know, our life with the sense of, yes, this can be practice in a significant way, not just in a, you know, in a superficial way. And again, you know, it's not, I would caution people who are listening not to take this on with the idea, okay, today I'm going to catch every quickly passing thought that goes through my mind. That's way too much. What I would suggest is just taking very short periods of time, like 5 minutes. Okay, for the next 5 minutes, I'm going to really keep an eye out for it. So that's, you know, within our capacity and our energy, and we might actually see something very clearly. And then we can, you know, do another 5 minutes a little later on. And like that, we build slowly from the bottom up. If we take, you know, give ourselves too hard a task in the beginning, then we just get discouraged and we give up.
I mentioned that we chatted before we started officially recording here. And I was asking you, you know, kind of what's up in your own practice. And you mentioned the notion of quickly passing thoughts. But the other thing that you said was on your mind these days is the tendency we have in meditation, even to be leaned into what's coming next, you know, sort of constantly scanning for a better option.
So again, this whole understanding, even though I had noticed that tendency for years, so just how, you know, we're with the in-breath, but leaning already into the out-breath, or, you know, feeling some sensation and leaning into wanting to make it more comfortable, or maybe being with an emotion, and people have different leaning into, either leaning into wanting to get rid of it or leaning into going deeper into it, but some way that our practice is anticipating and leaning into and having some desire for what the next moment will be and the next moment. I had been noticing this in my practice, but it really came to life for me a couple of years ago, you know, on a self-retreat where a thought came to mind. It's a line that is found very frequently in the Buddhist discourses. So I had read it, you know, a million times, and it's a very obvious statement. And so I thought I really understood it. And the line is, whatever has the nature to arise will also pass away. I had read that, as I say, many, many times. And yeah, that's an obvious statement of impermanence. You know, whatever has the nature to arise will also pass. But at this particular retreat and sitting, so I was just in my practice, in the flow of phenomena, of sensations and sounds and the breath, you know, everything that was happening. And this line came to mind. Whatever has the nature to arise will also pass away. But instead of it staying up kind of in the intellect and, yeah, just kind of understanding it conceptually, for whatever reason, that very line, it's as if it dropped right into the midst of the unfolding process. So it kind of took on, you know, a big life within the meditation. There was a startling conclusion. Whatever has the nature to arise will also pass away. Therefore, there's nothing to want. And there's nothing to want in this context really is about the meditative process. So I'm not talking about wanting other things in our lives or whatever. I'm talking about how we understand what the meditation is about. So it dropped into the process. There's nothing to want because whatever it is that I want out of the practice will also pass away. You know, if I want this sensation of tightness to ease. So that's a common one. You know, kind of there could be a slight aversion and wanting if there's something unpleasant. And so we're with it. We're kind of mindful of it. But again, leaning into the next moment. But then when I thought, oh, whatever has the nature to rise will also pass away. Therefore, there's nothing to want. I could feel my mind dropping back from any wanting at all. It was like dropping back from entanglement in the process. And then it was just things arising and passing, unfolding in their own way, but I was not entangled in it and no longer leaning forward. And there was a visceral feeling of that dropping back, basically from any identification with the process at all. You know, then things were just coming and going in their own time, according to their own laws. And then it got even more interesting because I realized that there's nothing to want is actually the essence of the whole practice. You know, after the Buddha's enlightenment and, you know, the verse that supposedly came to his mind, and this is in the text, where it said, realized is the unconditioned. This is after his great enlightenment. Realized is the unconditioned. Achieved is the end of craving. Which, of course, this is all about the Four Noble Truths. You know, the truth of suffering and the cause, which is craving, and the end of suffering, which is the end of craving, and how to do it, the Eightfold Path. And so just in that moment, oh, whatever has the nature to rise will also pass away. Therefore, there's nothing to want. And feeling the mind dropping back in just for that moment, and even for just a moment, not wanting. Right there, we're touching into the deepest part of the practice. We're actually experiencing the third noble truth in a momentary way. We can taste the end of suffering in that moment. Of non-craving, non-wanting, anything. It was a powerful seeing. Might be interesting for people, you know, if there's any interest, you know, in this particular perspective, just to play with this. And maybe just, you know, letting that phrase come to mind, either the whole phrase, you know, whatever has the nature to arise will also pass away, therefore there's nothing to want. And after a few times of that, maybe just shorten it to, there's nothing to want. Which is, I still use that, you know, in my sitting from time to time. I'll just, and very often, even now, after all these years of practice, oh, there's nothing to want. And I can feel that momentary release from a wanting I didn't even know was there. It gives us a real taste of it.
I've also heard you truncate the phrase right down to not wanting, just as a little mantra to drop into the mind.
Yeah. So again, your comment, I think, points to also the invitation for people just to experiment for themselves, you know, to if they kind of get the general principle and maybe try these suggestions, and then each person may find their own phrase, which, you know, has that effect. So we can be creative in that way.
More of my conversation with Joseph right after this.
As they say at Amica, empathy is our best policy. Whether you need auto, home, or life insurance, they're ready to help you protect the things that matter most to you. They're a mutual company, customer-owned, in service to you. Amica representatives are here when you need them, and you can take comfort knowing a real person will be there on the phone to take care of you, because the greatest measure of their success is your satisfaction. You can count on T-Mobile to help keep you connected. After investing billions to light up their network from big cities to small towns, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, when you switch to T-Mobile, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus Verizon and AT&T. Visit your neighborhood store or T-Mobile.com to switch. Plan savings with T-Mobile. Third line free on essentials via monthly bill credits versus comparable available plans. Plan features may vary. Credits stop if you cancel or change plans.
In our pre-show chat, you had asked me how my practice is going, and I said I would hold off on giving you the answer to that until we're recording. My thinking was maybe it would be interesting to give people a little bit of an insight what it's like when a teacher and his or her student are talking. In this case, often, you know, there's, you know, a lot of like slapping in the face and berating me for being a horrible student. I'm kidding. But to answer the question now, because I use a lot of these little phrases that you use in your own practice, in my practice, and a version of, I think maybe of what we're talking about here is a phrase I've heard you use is nothing to do, nowhere to go, something along those lines.
Something along those lines.
What is it again? That's what I've been doing in my head.
But. I think that works. But there are two kind of phrases that kind of are related. One is from actually Ajahn Buddhadasa, who was quite an iconoclastic Thai monk of the last century. He actually wrote a very interesting book called Heartwood of the Bodhi Tree, Ajahn Buddhadasa. He was kind of revolutionary for a Thai monk. He was very open-minded, kind of drew in from a lot of different traditions, which is unusual, you know, in that context. But he said, there's nothing to do, nothing to be, nothing to have. Nothing to do, nothing to be, nothing to have. So again, that's pointing to that sense of just dropping back, letting the process unfold. And then there's this other couple of lines from a very short poem by the Chinese poet Li Po, where he says, sitting quietly doing nothing. This may not be from Li Po. I may be confusing these poets. But anyway, the line is, sitting quietly doing nothing. Spring comes and the grass grows by itself. And just sitting quietly doing nothing, spring comes and the grass grows by itself. So it's all pointing to the same thing.
Yes, in my own practice, I spent a while, maybe a year and a half, 2 years, really focusing on, as you know, on the Brahma Viharas, or the four immeasurables, the heavenly abodes, loving kindness, compassion, equanimity, sympathetic joy, those styles of practice really were dominant in my practice for a while. I've been more recently focusing on just sort of an open awareness noting practice. So I practice a lot outside since my family had the great luxury of having our lease end in New York City and being able to lease something else in the suburbs. So I often sit outside. There's so much going on, so many crickets and birds and lawnmowers that it's not really conducive for me, at least, to concentrated practice, so that I just let whatever's coming. I'm just trying to be aware of whatever's coming up. And often I'll note it with a little phrase like hearing, seeing, thinking. But I do notice that there's a leaning in. There's a trying to be good at this. There's a not liking whatever's coming up and wanting the next thing. And so using little phrases like my bastardized version of the two lovely poetry lines that you just quoted of nothing to do, nowhere to go, just it jars me out of this kind of teeth gritted, leaned forward, I'm going to win at meditation attitude. And at least for a nanosecond or two, it's everything's unfolding on its own.
A couple of comments.
This is where I get told I'm to, about my mistakes. Go ahead.
No, it's a point that I think is really important for everyone. And that is, we want to interweave times of, we could call it directed awareness and choiceless awareness. Or we could call it even more effortless practice and making an effort. So in what I'm suggesting, there's nothing to want or there's nothing to do. It is good to practice with that for periods of time. At other times, if we find that, you know, our minds are just very distracted, we're just getting lost, or there's really a decision to cultivate a particular state, whether it's concentration or those Brahmaviharas, there definitely are times in the practice where we do want to be making an effort, you know, an effort at directing the mind in a certain way. So I don't know if this example will fit exactly, but maybe. You know, it's if you're going for a bike ride, you know, there are times when you want to pedal hard, you know, and build up speed and build up the momentum. And then at other times, you can just coast for a while, you know, and just let the bike roll on by itself. And then you need to pedal again, you know, to get the momentum. And so it's kind of like that in our practice. I wouldn't want to, you know, have people get the idea that, oh, we should never be making effort because that's going to the other extreme. It's really interweaving these two and kind of getting an intuitive feel for at a particular time, okay, so which approach, you know, is helpful, which is exactly what you did, you know, and kind of sitting outside, you know, you kind of naturally fell into this more open, choiceless awareness. At other times, you might choose, no, I'm going to just be with the breath for this time or just with the metta practice. So one second point to your description. Another phrase that might actually work better in that context, which it's possible it would cut through even that, you know, background tendency you noticed of wanting to do it perfectly or wanting to do it better. Just to hold the question in the mind, so moment after moment, what is being known? Just what is being known? Because then there's just the connection to that arising moment. It has nothing to do with what went before or what's going to come after. If you're just sitting there, okay, what's being known? And it's not that you necessarily have to keep repeating that phrase, but you could use the phrase judiciously occasionally just to remind yourself that that's the framework, you know, that you're creating, just what's being known. And that's something also that can be used in going for a walk. It's very interesting. And it reveals so much. It's really quite a powerful practice because we get a very immediate, deep sense of the momentariness of phenomena. You know, when we're just what's being known moment after moment. Oh, a sound, a sight, the feeling of the wind on the face, you know, warmth, coolness, sensations in a body, you know, seeing something. So moment after moment, we're just noticing that everything we take to be self is just this progression, this flow of changing objects. That what we call self is the flow. It's not that the flow is happening to someone.
Well, that's the power, and I'm quoting back to you, things I've heard you say either privately to me or in a teaching context, the power, and I've really felt this in my own practice, of the passive voice, using the passive voice as a mantra in your own mind. What is being known? The being known takes the you out of it. I'm leaning in and knowing all of this stuff. If you look for what is knowing, and again, I'm quoting you back to you, if you look for what is knowing, you won't find some little homunculus between your ears. And that is just that little act is bumping you up against the mystery of consciousness, which is pretty revolutionary.
Yeah. So again, these practices are really simple, but profound, you know, and that they can be applied even for short periods of time. And that's the point I'd really like to emphasize. You know, we don't have to think, oh, if I can't do it for the whole day or even for a whole hour, then it's not worth doing. Now, sometimes just, you know, these very deep insights for a few moments really are planting a very powerful seed within us of understanding.
Let me ask, this is me exercising my prerogative as the host to ask a question that may not be applicable to everybody, so I apologize in advance. But I've noticed that for me recently, I'm writing a book. I've been writing a book for several years. I will be writing this book for several more years. It's basically like being on a medieval rack for several years. It's terrible. And since it's memoir, it's often very difficult or embarrassing or shame-inducing stuff. And I notice that while I'm writing, I'm overcome sometimes with this sort of fatigue. And so it's not uncommon for me to just lie down on the floor and do a noting practice. I know that lying down was one of the four classical postures in Buddhism. And so it's, you know, traditionally there's not a, you know, there's not sort of injunction against lying down, but I still feel a little guilty when I do it. Like I should be sitting up ramrod straight when I'm meditating. What's your take on that?
My take on a lot of things. This is one of my all-purpose mantras, whatever works. You know, so as you're lying down, what you really need to notice is, you know, in that position, are you as alert as when you're sitting up, or are you tending to doze off? You know, if the mind is going into a kind of hazy confusion, then it might not be the best posture. You know, if it's not, if the mind's really awake and alert, it seems fine. And maybe lying flat on the floor, you have to see, but if it were tending to doze, there are other relaxed positions which may be not quite such a complete reclining. You know, maybe sitting back in a recliner. You know, so your body's supported, you're really comfortable, so there's that level of relaxation, but you're not kind of in a sleep position. But this is all to experiment with, because for different people, it'll be different. It's whatever works. And it's totally fine to find, especially at times, a comfortable posture, you know, a relaxed posture. There is a value to a not-so-relaxed posture, you know, where we're sitting either cross-legged or in a chair, but upright, because those kind of postures actually take some effort. It's not as effortless as just lying back, you know, in a recliner. When I talked about how we want to interweave times of more direction or more effort and then more effortlessness or choicelessness. But one of the principles, not only in meditation, but in life, is that effort creates energy. So an easy example for understanding this is, you know, if we're feeling tired and then we make the effort to go out and exercise, we generally feel much more energized afterwards than before because we made the effort to do it. This applies to the meditation practice too, and I've seen this very often in different contexts, that by making an effort, we're raising the energy level in the whole system. And as that happens, then it becomes easier to, I'll say this word cautiously, to coast in a more effortless manner. But by coast, I don't mean non-mindful. I mean that it's happening more by itself without making the effort. But it's having made the effort which gets us to that point of momentum where that can happen. And that's why I talk about this interweaving, you know, of times of making effort, whether it's by a more formal posture or it could be the effort of coming back more frequently to the primary object rather than openness and choiceless awareness, because it takes an effort to do that. You know, and then, as I said, the energy really gets stronger in the whole system. And then we can settle back in a more choiceless, effortless way. So it's so interesting. I mean, I hope for me, you know, what's fueled all of these years of practice. So it's been about 5 million now, you know. It is just so interesting, you know, to watch or to understand what our mind bodies are doing and how they're relating and how this affects that, you know, and what leads to suffering, what brings greater peace. So it's that kind of interest which can really create a lot of energy for practice.
In terms of what practice we do when, just to pick up on what you're talking about there in the spirit of whatever works, I do notice that it's more art than science, obviously, but playing with different types of practice given the circumstances of my life and in my mind. So if I'm writing and I'm feeling just awful, which I know is, you know, the body basically revolting against, you know, this process of looking where I probably shouldn't, or just telling me this is hard, take a break. So then, yeah, maybe I will lie down and just do a more relaxed open awareness practice. Then sometimes I'll wake up in the morning and think, you know what, I have a little time right now. I could sit inside where it's pretty quiet and do a more directed metta practice or just be with the breath and really tune up my concentration. And then other times I'll think, you know, it's a beautiful day. I mean, there's not too much sun on this side of the house. Maybe I'll sit there and just tune into whatever's happening outside. Or, you know what, I'm a little sleepy. I want to practice, so I'll do a standing or a walking practice. And it's really just, it's taken me a while, a little bit over a decade, which I know compared to you isn't that much practice, but it's not nothing, to just figure out what is appropriate when.
Yeah. You know, and I think this really, in a way, points to the intuitive nature of the whole process. So it's almost learning to trust our intuition in these different situations, because usually our intuition is not infallible, for sure. And sometimes we can have intuitions that are off. But I would say generally, at least in my experience, generally, they've been guiding me in the right way. You know, and so it's learning to trust that. But I did want to make another point to what you described of, you know, sitting and writing the book and then getting into all the stuff of your life and your mind in the book and then feeling maybe exhausted by it all. Maybe before you go to the let's relax on the floor, what came to mind as you were describing it would be a little reflection on your motivation for writing the book. You know, because it can easily, well, as you know, and anybody who's practiced knows, we have a lot of mixed motivations. One would have to be a saint to have totally pure motivation all the time. So that's kind of a given. The challenge is that we become aware of the range of our motivations rather than controlled by them, you know. So especially in writing a memoir, I could well imagine that at times you're really connected with your initial motivation, that it be of some help and be of some service to people, you know, in your description. And at other times, maybe that motivation is forgotten. And to use your words, these are not my words about you. These are your words about you. What a jerk I am. You know, so right there, we've gone from altruistic motivation to a lot of self-ing. In the very same activity of writing the book. So it would be interesting to notice when you're beginning to feel exhausted by it all. I would just see what happens if you kind of realign with your initial motivation for it and see if even just by doing that, that changes your energy.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought this up because I think it's applicable not just to the rather narrow category of people who are working on a memoir, but it's applicable to everybody. And I'll just tell you, I've been thinking a lot about motivation because I've been talking to you about motivation for a long time, and these conversations come back in my mind not infrequently. And so I've been doing two things. One is to try to, in the morning, before I do anything else, just say to myself, all right, what is my motivation? And I don't have a, I mentioned it recently on a podcast, I don't have like a mellifluous phrase, but it's something along the lines of, my goal is to do work that helps other people live better lives, and in the process of doing that work, to have positive relationships. Said more skillfully or pithily by the lead singer of the indie rock band Apples in Stereo, it's to make awesome, I think he used the swear words, but I'll say stuff, and be kind in the process. And I try to just bring that to mind. And then I had a piece of paper that I put up on my computer recently that said two things. One is go easy. And the other was try to remember how helpful this could be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think these reminders, I think, are really helpful. So I just came across a story. I think it was in an article in Tricycle magazine. So I'll just paraphrase it because it made a point that I think we don't pay enough attention to. So it was a story about, you know, in the Buddhist time, and there was this young Brahmin kid, you know, that high caste in ancient India, who was just very kind of spoiled, you know, and he would always get whatever he wanted. And so he happened to be near the Buddha when the Buddha was receiving, you know, some alms food, and somebody gave the Buddha an Indian sweet, you know, to put in his bowl. And this little Brahmin kid said, I want that laddu. Laddu was the name of the sweet. I want that laddu. And the Buddha said, I'll give it to you if you say, I don't want the laddu. So the Brahmin kid said, I don't want the laddu. And the Buddha gave it to him. And the story goes on about some other things, but afterwards, kind of the monks were asking the Buddha, what was all that about? And the Buddha was saying, you know, for, again, this is in the context of traditional, you know, Buddhist Hindu cosmology, you know, of many lifetimes and all that, but it's also applicable to a single lifetime. He said, for so long, this Brahmin kid had just been indulging all his wants, you know, his wants. And so just to have him say for that moment, I don't want the laddu, according to the story, you know, the Buddha saw that just that one articulation, I don't want the laddu, was planting a seed of letting go or renunciation that in some future life was going to result in that young Brahmin kid, some future life, becoming a monk, ordaining, becoming fully enlightened. And I just love the story, apocryphal as it probably is. But just the idea that even small seeds, you know, of wholesome thought, I think we underappreciate the potentiality within a seed. You know, and sometimes it is quite remarkable. I mean, it's obvious all around us how, you know, take a seed, an acorn, and it becomes a huge tree. But you look at the acorn, that seems so insignificant. And yet the potentiality within it is immense. Well, our minds even more so. You know, and so we shouldn't overlook just taking any opportunity like you do when you wake up in the morning, just planting these seeds. Because I have a firm belief that they do have tremendous power. Again, not necessarily immediately, but they bear fruit in their own time. So it's important to do. You know, and it's not hard to do, you know, just it's just one little seed and one little seed. Every time we're doing the metta practice, the loving kindness, we're just repeating a phrase, you know, may you be at ease, may you be happy, may you be free of suffering. We're just repeating that it's seeds, you know, and over time they grow.
I have three little things to say based on the foregoing. One is just noticing that I miss doing, you know, I spent so much time where my whole practice was dead, including a couple of full, like, 9-day retreats, one of them with you, where that's all I was doing was the metta practice. And I could see that my mind is different now than that I'm not doing it as much. That just the baseline level of warmth is a little lower. The other thing is that whole setting of intention or, you know, putting up a sign on my computer. I know the me of 11 years ago would have, you know, had a little, you know, like vomit up in his throat at hearing that, you know, like it's cheesy or whatever. But it really is helpful in my own experience that, yeah, I'm not motivated purely by altruism at all. But to the extent that I can shift the ratio, even just a few percentage points, that altruism burns so much cleaner as a motivation than the, you know, how am I going to look? How many books are people going to buy? What are the critics going to say? And blah, blah, blah. I mean, that's all there still, but just turning down the volume on it incrementally is incredibly useful. And then the third thing to pick up on the seed, what brought to mind when you were using that analogy of the seed is that, you know, the, as I understand it, the ancient word for meditation, bhavana, translates to cultivation. And that is what we're doing here. It's like over and over and in so many different ways. That's what your, as I understand your career as a teacher to being about, just giving us all these tools to do this cultivation from as many angles as possible so that we can, you don't have to believe in future lives, fine. I've seen no evidence, but I'm open to it, but I'm certainly not pounding the table saying it's true. But in this life, you can just see the fruit.
Absolutely. And I want to go back to something you said before, which just raised an interesting point for me. When you were talking about, you know, putting the little sign on your computer and whether it's cheesy or not, but, you know, you actually found it helpful. It's helpful in a couple of ways. One is that it's just a reminder, you know, it's planting the seed. But it's also helpful in the same way that formally taking the precepts is helpful. You know, generally in, you know, in the Buddhist teachings, there are five basic ethical precepts for lay people. You know, of not killing and not stealing and not committing sexual misconduct, not lying, and not taking intoxicants which just confuse the mind. Okay, so those are the basic five ethical framework for living. What I found is that by formally taking them, whether some people maybe take them every morning, you know, or once a week or once a month, whatever it is, but by formally taking them and articulating them, not only are we planting the seed in that moment, but what I found is that having taken them, when I'm about or if I'm about to break one of them, having taken the precept, it sort of works like a mindfulness bell, you know, so, and it highlights, oh, do I really want to do this? This is, you know, this might be breaking a precept. And I use it a lot, comes to mind a lot with speech, because that's the easiest. See, the others, you know, it's not that hard not to kill and not to steal for most people, you know. But in speech, and maybe for the sexual misconduct precept, for some people that might be also a very powerful reminder. But it really comes into play in the moment when we're about to break them. And so that's how I understood that the same power of putting a little note on your computer or giving voice to it, you know, just having articulated it will really serve you, I think, throughout the day, as it'll come as a reminder, you know, at critical moments, sometimes.
The little expression that I heard recently that I keep using both in my own life and in on the show, and maybe it's even the title of the next book. I don't know who said this, but a guest on this show recently told me something that was said to her by a teacher when she was complaining about loving kindness practice. The teacher said to her, "If you can't be cheesy, you can't be free."
Great line. Yeah. And by the way, Dan, are you leaning into your next book?
Yeah. I'm trying to think. I was going to say 1,000%, but maybe 1,000,000%.
Okay. You might want to watch that one. this is a good example. So the difference between having a thought arise about the next book and seeing it as just a thought coming and going, or having the thought arise and capturing you and taking you on a little emotional ride about the next book. So that's the difference. So the thought may be the same, but are you leaning into it, or are you seeing it for just what it is as a thought in the moment? So right there, and then you can just extend this to everything. This is why awareness of thought, and you know, going back to the discussion we started with, being aware of even the quickly passing ones can have such a profound influence on how we're living. Because mostly we are leaning into the story and it's taking us for a ride.
Yeah, and it's not a joy ride. Have I given you the opportunity to say everything that's on your mind, or did I commit malpractice in any way by failing to ask you some question?
No. There's often not much in my mind until you start provoking it a little bit. That's why I need you, Dan.
I guarantee you the arrow of need points in the other direction primarily. It's going to sound weak and perfunctory to even say it, but it is genuinely a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, and always, it's always great. Thank you.
Big thanks again to Joseph. And a reminder, he's got that newly reissued book, The Experience of Insight, A Simple and Direct Guide to Buddhist Meditation, available now from Shambhala or wherever you get your books. This show is made by Samuel Johns, DJ Kashmir, Kim Baikama, Maria Wortel, and Jen Poyant, with audio engineering from Ultraviolet Audio. As always, a hearty salute to my ABC News colleagues, Ryan Kessler and Josh Cohan. We'll see you all on Friday for a bonus. If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.
I'm Shimon Yai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
All of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest, and they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now I'm coming back as a judge and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, the competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.